middle promise. The middle promise. I like to look at men. Yesterday at the gem superstore, I gave the elegant Somali in the next queue a long, smouldering up and down with lots of lashes. Like a pirate, I swung onto his clean brown deck, and his coffee eyes poured right through me. I was nothing more than a vessel on the ocean of Sunday afternoon, becalmed in the middle of the room, almost invisible. My womb turns restlessly in its warm belly, a slight but significant ache. I count my periods. My eggs are all but spent. I can still hear the music of sex, but I'm no longer in the dance. I am a walled, empty temple where silence flowers. In the beginning, we promised nothing but the firm hunger of our perfect bodies, and at the end, the aches, the dreams of bones, mortal wisdom as a final breath, the gift of living to the gifted dead. The middle seems so promiseless, yet we have learnt that the cost of things is not the same as the value of things. Having tasted loss, we ask for more. We calibrate minutes in love, degrees in uncertainty. Our voices grow stronger as our bodies fade. The other day they found a buried city, thousands of years old. In the kitchen place, an unbroken clay pot, its whole body held in the silting earth. We are aging vessels dug up to face the light, unbroken, still useful, filled with stories.
Good day, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the David Crypt Podcast. My name is Mthabisi Sithole, and I am sitting here with Philippa Yard de Villiers, South African writer, playwright, and performance artist. Philippa?
Hello, Mthabisi.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for sitting down with me to have this chat. I'm excited to get to know you and your work a little more.
Thank you. I always like talking to young poets.
I'm sure like most of the time it's like a little bit of just questions and adoration nonstop.
Sometimes, but that I also get the challenge, and that's also quite interesting.
What's the challenge?
The challenge is, okay, for example, so as a biracial, transracial adoptee, I have got a kind of complicated relationship to racial identity. And so my poems have been really exploring that over the years. Yeah. And at times people have felt that they're not radical enough, or, you know, that they don't know what I'm trying to say. They don't understand, you know, make it angry and annoyed.
You use the word radical. Radical, like, in what sense? What could possibly be the expectation of radical poetry from yourself?
Well, I think that we've got a long tradition in this country of poetry for social change, you know?
Right, yeah.
And so it's not the confessional poetry. That's considered to be bourgeois and indulgent. Mm. So, you know, you're supposed to be turning your pen to the struggle of the masses. And I agree that that is an important part of all poetry. But I have to write about my own life. I'm trying to work my way out of my own labyrinth here.
Mm. I mean, a lot of your poetry tends to almost be a negotiation of your own identity, or figuring out of your own identity, understanding it and all that. And you said that with the country's history, a lot of the poetry tends to address with the issues that plague the masses, right? So if you as an individual poet or figuring your own identity and discussing your own identity through your poetry, is that not in its own way radical, I suppose, because you are amongst these masses looking at your own identity. Or I feel rather when I read your work that you address your story as opposed to writing a poetry that tries to envelope everyone else's story.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to find the language to describe or to embody my experience. And so that does draw on the masses and other poetry, popular poetry.
Yeah.
One of my big influences is Kiaripeti Khosetsile, you know?
Yes.
So even in the poem that I wrote for him for his 70th birthday, I'm trying to do like, I'm trying to get a whiff of him. I think I have multiple influences, and so it will come across in different kinds of ways. But fundamentally, I'm just trying to tell my story.
And how did it come about that, I mean, with your upbringing and your background and being biracial, that you found poetry to be this tool that you could actually use to tell your own story and, I suppose, understand your own identity?
Well, I don't know if it's so much of a tool, but it's really just the thing itself, you know, the thing that it's not like I picked up poetry and, you know, as if it's a hammer or spanner.
Yeah.
It actually grew out of me.
Yeah.
But it grew out of me because my mother used to read poetry to me. She liked poetry. She liked a particular poet. And then I went through a religious phase, and the Bible is full of poetry, and I got involved in that. And then as a young kid, I also just really enjoyed memorizing poems, and I was really into Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll. So, you know, so I memorized Jabberwocky. I learned those poems, and I guess that also becomes the kind of the material that I'm sort of working with, you know. So like when I was commissioned to write the Commonwealth poem in 2014, I was asked to write a poem celebrating Nelson Mandela's contribution to the world. And I was quite irritated with the British asking me to do this when, during the 80s, when I first started getting involved in politics, that he was basically persona non grata in Thatcher's United Kingdom, you know. But so in that poem, I have this line, which is just from Lewis Carroll, will you won't you walk behind Mandela. It's a part of, it's in Through the Looking Glass, I think.
Right.
Where it's called The Lobster Quadrille, and it's just this crazy poem. But there's a playfulness in the language.
Mm.
And because I was briefed that there would be 2,000 children at the ceremony, I wanted to have a part of the poem that appealed to children.
So, as you mentioned, you were the Commonwealth poet in 2014.
Yeah.
And that was after publishing two of your collections, Taller Than Buildings and The Everyday Wife.
Yes.
And also presenting your original Skin production, One Woman Show.
Mm.
You published your first collection at the age of 40.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I suppose maybe it comes with like just being young and trying to figure my way around with things. But I'm encountering such a crazy influx of young poets just running to get published, running to have their own collection go out there. And I can't help but ask myself, how is it that you, at the age of 40, were just publishing your first collection? What had you been doing before then? What was happening?
No, I mean, I really didn't think that anything that I wrote was worth reading, you know, that anyone would be interested in reading it. I really felt like I was doing it for therapy. And I loved poetry and I loved poems. And like, as I went through the world, I started off as an actress. I trained as a journalist, which that paid the fees for me to go to acting school. And then I went to acting school in Paris for 2 years, and then I came back to South Africa and I worked as an actress for about 8 years or so, 10 years. And then during that process,
This was in the early 2000s where you
no,
were
this was in
working.
the 90s.
90s. Okay.
And during that process, I happened upon a book called The Artist's Way.
Yes.
And I did that course, and I did it twice, in fact. And it was a very interesting process because it really delved into what I really thought I wanted to do with my life.
What
And
was it about?
the Artist's Way, it's a workbook.
Right.
It's a 3-month course
Okay.
in discovering your creative side. And so I was an actress. I was waiting around for auditions. I was going to auditions. I was working, and I did this thing when I'd just done a TV series called Maul of Fish, and so I didn't have to work for like a month. I just
Yeah.
had time to write and think, and so it's a 12-week course, so I could just get into it, and it really required you to write quite a lot. And that in doing that, I discovered that there were so many stories in me. And at the time, I'd been told that I was adopted, but I didn't know who my parents were. I didn't have any idea about that. And then the laws changed in South Africa, and I was allowed to actually explore and discover who my biological parents were.
Is
So,
this like post 1994?
yeah.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, I had all this thing. I thought maybe that my father was Aboriginal because my mother was Australian,
All right.
and I knew that I wasn't white, you know. And so I just had this big question mark over me all this time, and I just think that that was something that also kept me from actually declaring anything. Nothing felt defined or for certain. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't finish the story. I couldn't actually really have access to my own story. And when I found my biological parents, it was like a kind of an unlocking of parts of myself that actually I thought, oh, I can write this and I can tell people this story and they might enjoy it. And they might. And the more I wrote, the more I shared it, the more people responded. And then I still felt like I was useless and I couldn't write really. I wanted to really know how to write. And so I discovered that there was this course called Crossing Borders, which was for young South African writers teamed up with British writers. And so it was an 8-month mentorship. And in that mentorship, we had to produce 6 poems every 6 weeks. And we got strict feedback from that. And at the end of that process, I had a manuscript. And so again, I didn't think that anyone would be interested in publishing it. But I entered a competition, which is called the Community Publishing Grant, which is set up by the Centre for the Book. And you send in the manuscript, and they chose that. There were five. They choose 5 a year. And they gave you enough money to print your book, and then you become your own publisher. Yeah, and so through that process, also, I met Colleen Higgs, who is a
Who?
publisher
Okay.
and a great poet as well, and a writer. And so she was the person who initiated this community publishing grant. Okay. She's somebody who has done a lot for self-publishing in South Africa, because she correctly judged that we really need to get a lot of stories out there, and publishing houses have got other concerns, so they won't always make it possible for everyone to have their story published.
Mm.
So I got this book, and I said to myself, well, no one's really going to read it. Actually, I don't think.
So this is Taller Than Buildings.
Taller Than Buildings, okay. Yeah. That was in 2006.
Mm.
And so I treated it like a passport, mm. you know? But I had also become part of a circle of poets.
Mm.
I called them the Newtown Ecstatics. The school of poets. It was Maisha Jenkins, Makosisa Nakaba, Napo Mashiani, Lebo Mashile. And, you know, so this was like a community project. They did Jozi House of Poetry, which was their session once a month.
Yeah.
And I would go there and read my poems.
Mm.
Before I published, I'd go and read the poems and get a response from them and listen to them out loud.
Mm.
So that was also how I became used to the sound of my own poetry.
Right.
But also they were incredibly supportive. And so when Taller Than Buildings came back from the publishers, Makosisa Nakaba said, I want to be the first one to buy it. And she bought a copy. And then Napo Mashiani said, I want to be seen with a published poet. And so off we went to Rosebank. She said, Wear something smart, let's go. So we went to Rosebank together with this book, and we went and looked at Stone Cherry, and, you know, like just showing the book to everybody. out and about. And there we saw John Machikiza and Kiarepeti Khosetsile having coffee in Rosebank. And so John had just been working with Napo, and I also knew John from the market, but also Kiarepeti Khosetsile. I had this long-standing, like, admiration. I just desperately wanted him to see me. I've been stalking him since, like, 1993, the first time I heard Red Song, of his that was put to music by Vusi Mahlasela. So I'd been stalking Khosetsile and trying to get him to give me attention, and he'd been very kind of like not really that interested, because who was I?
Right.
But now I had something, you know.
Published.
Yeah.
A thing.
And he said, I want to buy this book. I'm going to buy this book. And Machikiza said, no, I'm going to buy it first.
Oh.
And so they were playing with me, but he took the book, and then, like, 2 weeks later, we were both reading at the Jozi Spoken Word Festival.
Mm.
And I was scared to ask him. And I said, what do you think of the book? And he said, I'm not going to talk much about it, but it's very, very good. Mm. And he was very kind about it.
Mm.
And then about 2 weeks later, I got a call from the Department of Arts and Culture inviting me to go to Cuba.
Mm.
To a poetry festival with a delegation of South African poets. And that, I suppose, was just the beginning, you know? But I think it was just that thing of, like, deciding to write the story and share the story. Like, just, and it was difficult because my parents, my mother particularly, she didn't want the story to come out. They were very, very angry with me for writing that I was adopted and raised in this white family, and there were some problems there. It was a bit complicated.
I mean, but clearly people were willing to listen and read.
They liked it. And so then it just one thing led to another. And then all of a sudden, so in the middle of being an actor, I started exploring writing because I wanted to have a job which was a little bit more substantial than acting, you know, in terms of finances. Because I wanted to have a child.
Right.
So I started writing for television.
Mm.
And I did that for 10 years. And while I was writing for television, the poems kept coming up in the margins.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd put them to one side and then go and read them at Jozi House of Poetry. And, you know, so one thing led to another. It wasn't like I planned the career.
So how then does Original Skin come about in all of that activity and everything you're doing?
When we started the Crossing Borders project, I think it was just, it was quite an incredible thing that happened, because that when once I connected with my mentor, there's something unlocked in me. Mm. And I sat down and I wrote a play in 24 hours. A whole play about identity and being mixed up and race and all of this kind of stuff, but set in the future, very, very strange. And we took it to a festival in Natal, in KZN, where it was a rehearsed reading of the play, and it did very well there.
Yeah.
But when we came back and were trying to stage it, we decided, no, let's start again. And I worked with a director called Robert Coleman, and we just basically rewrote the whole story. But just because I had sort of made it all very metaphorical, you know, to try and not to make it look like it's me.
Yeah.
But so with because under Robert's guidance, I wrote the story as if, it, you know, I tried to write the story of what it was like growing up in this white family. And so it also was another thing that it just went. I don't know how it just got its own momentum, you know. It was invited to Grahamstown, it was invited to Germany. I did it in for trade unions and for various people. And so, yeah. But you know what, Nta, I really think that there's something magical about the story and me, because the kind of people that came. So when we had worked for about 6 months, Robert and I, and then we managed to have a script.
Yeah.
So then we did a rehearsed reading, which was almost like the play, but I had the script in my hand.
Mm.
And we did it at the Market Theatre Laboratory, and we invited the head honchos of the Market Theatre at the time, Malcolm Perkey and his team. And this man walked in, this American man, who happened to be in South Africa, and he was volunteering at Cotlands because he had an adopted black daughter, and he wanted to know everything about what that means, you know? Yeah. So he became a friend. He lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
His name is Michael Kearns. And so, like, you know, those kind of magical things happened. Those kind of magical connections were made through the work, you know.
Yeah.
Lebo Mashile's mom came to see it, and she said, "It's like your own TRC." And
oh, wow.
And it was. It was like a reckoning with where I came from. And it was like to say thank you.
Mm.
And I'm going this way now, you know. And so, yeah, that was Original Skin. And I did it for a few years at schools and in various kind of places. And then in 2015, it was invited onto the main festival at Grand Makanda. And so I did it there for the last time.
The last time? Or do you think you would ever, like, stage it again?
It's a bit difficult because there's a lot of child in the play. You know, there's a lot of little children, and I'm a big woman now. So it's a bit funny to see this old lady, like, doing cartwheels. But, you know, I think that for me, actually more than identity, racial identity, is the reckoning with politics. Because I've always felt that our lives are just always being crushed by the weight of history in South Africa. Everyone's like, where were you? You know, like everyone's had to, like, people have also kind of had to invent, like, some kind of political involvement that wasn't necessarily there. And I got bust by José Tile, because when we were in Cuba, he said to me, I said, like, I was a, I'm a 60, I'm a 76 generation person. Because in 1976, I was 10 years old.
Right.
And it was the year that I distinct. It was the first time I remember politics.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the first time that I connected the fact that I looked different from other people
yeah.
with this other big thing that was happening in our country. And so I just very carefully, easily just collected that history with my history. And Khosetsile said to me, but you had ballet lessons in 76. You know, you had a swimming pool. You were living in a white, you were living in a white suburb. You can't claim that.
Wow.
And it was like, wow, that's so true. I just appropriated that because I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be on the right side of history.
Is that what it was as a child, though? Like, that, or whatever
no.
would have made of that connection?
No, that was the connection that I was making post all of
post
that time.
Post-77.
But
okay.
As a child, like, I was, I mean, I've got a poem here in Ice Cream Headache, which is just shows where I was at that age. I was like totally this white child, you know, like I just said some very, very problematic things, you know.
Would it be too much of an imposition to ask you to read it, please?
Oh man, it's all out there, man. Nothing to hide anymore. Okay, so this poem is called Childhood Melodies. Halloween is scaring and pretending in real life when you're 10. After June 1976, Mommy took me on sabbatical with her, trick-or-treating in suburban Oak Park, Chicago, scampering skeletons and ghosts and zombies, light pierced the safety net of dark green trees, wide, immense streets, and Tiffany's mom checked our loot because kids' mouths get ripped to shreds because razor blades planted in apples by bad men become because poison candy, perverts. I thrilled to the danger, her rage seething in those big words, and Mr. Harris, with an afro out to here, took me to McDonald's because he thought I was a Soweto refugee, but I told him what I knew. I'm not black, I declared. Blacks are uncivilized. They will never rule our country. They need us whites. I survived tonsillitis and shut up or I'll give you something to really cry about and children should be seen and not heard. Open wide, the doctor's brittle balsa wood depressor on my yellow tongue. And when I was fully grown, I wondered why, when I rang a stranger's doorbell, it felt like sweets rained from the sky, like bombs in a World War II movie. A childhood melody, but need dirt mark me, but need dirt mark me, mark fit. So, like, all this stuff, like, especially like, since like Fees Must Fall, Rose Must Fall, and like the struggles in the United States as well, Black Lives Matter. There's been a lot of discussion of about microaggressions, you know, and like my entire life was microaggressions, just all the way. And so I guess for me that that poem was sort of making my peace with it or just going out. It doesn't kill you. It makes you stronger. It's not right. It's very clear to me that that is not right. But for a really long time, especially at the age of 10, there was nothing wrong with what they were saying.
I mean, it doesn't kill you, makes you stronger, but also as an adult gives you things to work through.
Yeah, and it gives you material.
Sad but true. So that is from your last collection, Ice Cream Headache in My Bone.
Yeah.
So since the publication of your last collection, what have you been up to?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be invited to edit a special edition of the Atlanta Review, which is a prestigious poetry journal in the United States. And so that was a wonderful opportunity to bring a whole lot of South African women poets onto the page, and that was a really amazing experience. And you know, I teach at WITS, and I'm working on my PhD, which is a long poem. And yeah, I'm always publishing in anthologies, and like it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
And also entering short story competitions, just trying to get be a better writer.
I mean, what's like? I'm more familiar with you as, or with your work rather, as a poet. Your short stories. What's your relationship with short stories?
For me, in fact, I feel like the text of a short story can also be like a poem. You know, and in the oral tradition, the short story and the poem are interchangeable, you know? Mm. It's just called one thing, prose, poetry. But because of publishing and because it has to be marketed in a certain way, but there's a lot of similarities. And so the first short stories I started writing they did resemble poems, and I suppose that also will bring me to that other thing that you wanted to talk about, which is Haiban.
Haiban, alright.
So, yeah. So Haiban is a Japanese poetic form, which was invented around about the 16th century by Basho, who was the father of haiku.
Mm.
But so a haiban has a prose element, and then it's sealed off with either one or two or three haiku. And so it's been an amazing experience, because there's an organization in Japan which is trying to revive this tradition.
Yeah.
So they hold this competition every year, and I've been entering this competition for not every year, but for the last 10 years.
Mm.
And so one of the reasons why I like entering it is not because there's money, but they give you very, very rigorous feedback. And you get feedback from three different judges, written feedback. So you really get a sense of whether your poem is hitting the mark.
Mm. It's been so lovely talking to you, Philippa. And as opposed to putting a complete full stop on it, I think it's best to say until next time. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you and learning from you here, just like hearing your story as well. Thank you.
Thank you.